This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, October 9th, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, tainted medication causes a nationwide spread of meningitis. Consumer advocates and lawmakers are calling for more oversight. Clashes continue along the Turkey-Syria border. We'll hear a firsthand account from Aleppo, where fierce fighting rages. And Florida voters will decide on a slate of constitutional amendments. One of them would remove the state's extra privacy rights on abortion. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm George Lavender with these headlines for Free Speech Radio News. More than 30 people were killed by Nigerian troops in the northeastern city of Maiduguri. Government forces opened fire after two soldiers were injured in a bomb blast targeting an army patrol vehicle in the city. FSRN's Samuel Okocha reports from Lagos.
Maiduguri is one of several towns in northern Nigeria to have seen fighting between government forces and the militant Islamist group Boko Haram in recent months. Over the weekend, Nigerian troops launched a renewed offensive against the sect and claimed to have killed 30 of its members in Damaturu, a northern northeastern city. The bombing of an army patrol vehicle in Maiduguri Monday appeared to come as revenge, but the army responded with what eyewitnesses described as a shooting spree that killed dozens of civilians. Several buildings were also set on fire during the attack. Malam Abubakar, who comes from Maiduguri, told FSRN that brutality by government troops was nothing new and that civilians live in fear because of harassment from soldiers sent to secure the area. Speaking to the BBC, Army spokesperson Lieutenant Colonel Sagar Musa denied that civilians had been killed. Samuel Okocha, FSRN, Lagos.
In Pakistan, a 14-year-old student who publicly criticized the Taliban's closure of girls' schools has been shot in the northwest of the country. Zain Hadisli reads for our reporter in Peshawar, Gabe Matthews.
Malala Yousafzai was shot in her neck and head as she left school in Mangora City in the Swat Valley this morning. She was taken by a helicopter to the intensive care unit in Peshawar Combined Military Hospital, where her condition is not said to be life-threatening. Two of her friends were also injured in the attack. Yousafzai is well known in Pakistan for an online journal she kept for the BBC between 2003 and 2009 when the Taliban controlled the Swat Valley. In it, she criticized the Taliban's closure of girls' schools like her own. Speaking in January 2012, she explained what motivated her activism.
Study, my aim was to go to school and my aim was to learn. If it was at any place, if it was at school, if it was at home, if it was at a boarding school, but my aim was to study and to struggle for my education and to struggle for my rights.
Her criticism of the Taliban school closures earned her widespread praise. She was nominated for the International Children's Peace Prize and received the first National Peace Award from the Pakistani government. But she was also the subject of threats of retaliation. Today, a spokesperson for the Taliban accepted responsibility for the attack and said anyone who spoke against the group would be targeted. For FSRN, I'm Zain Qadisli, reading for Gabe Matthews in Peshawar.
In Greece, thousands of people took to the streets today to protest German Chancellor Angela Merkel's visit to Athens. It's the Chancellor's first visit to the country since widespread cuts to public spending took effect. The cuts are part of a controversial bailout agreement negotiated by the German Chancellor. Greece's government agreed to implement austerity measures in exchange for several billion dollars from the International Monetary Fund, the European Central Bank, and the European Commission. Greece is currently in negotiations about the next payment. Without the almost $15 billion, the Greek government would be bankrupt by November. Demonstrators in Athens protested the measures, which many view as making the situation worse. One in four Greek workers are currently out of work. Also in Greece, a lawyer for 15 people arrested during an anti-fascist demonstration told The Guardian newspaper they were subject to, quote, Abu Ghraib-style torture while in police custody. The group was arrested on September 30th at a protest against Golden Dawn, the extreme right-wing political party that won 18 seats in the last Greek election. The protesters say they were punched, kicked, spat on, and denied access to water and legal representation for 19 hours. They also say police officers told them that their home addresses would be given to Golden Dawn, a party with a reputation of violence. Demonstrators marched to the Parliament building in Nairobi today, calling Kenyan lawmakers thieves. The 222 members of Parliament awarded themselves $105,000 each, payable at the end of the current term in 2013. The bonus was added as a last-minute amendment to the Finance Act, voted on late last Thursday night. The bonus award comes as public sector workers in Kenya are demanding better pay and working conditions. Farmers in one state in southern India are celebrating an apparent victory today in a long-running dispute over water rights. The farmers in Karnataka had complained that the state government was releasing badly needed water from a local dam, sending it to the neighbouring state of Tamil Nadu. On Monday, the state government shut off the flow of water. For FSRN, Prabhakar Mani Tiwari has more.
The decision to shut off the flow of water follows mass protests by farmers in Karnataka demanding that the state government take action. On Monday, Karnataka stopped releasing water from the Kaveri River to Tamil Nadu, citing low storage in its reservoir. The Kaveri River Authority, headed by Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, had instructed Karnataka to release more than 67,000 gallons of water to Tamil Nadu over a 3-week period. The river, which originates in Karnataka and flows into Tamil Nadu, has been at the center of a century-old dispute over water rights. Both states argue that they need water for their farmers. The government of Tamil Nadu has launched a legal case in the Supreme Court of India against the decision to cut off the water. Prabhakar Mani Tiwari, FSRN India.
And those are the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. In Oakland, California, I'm George Lavender.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. According to new information from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention today, the outbreak of fungal meningitis has spread. At least 11 people have died, another 119 are infected, and as many as 13,000 people across the country are at risk of getting the rare disease from tainted medication. A federal investigation has linked the outbreak to the New England Compounding Center in Farmingham, Massachusetts, that manufactured the steroid injection used to cure back pain. Now, members of Congress and consumer advocates are demanding more regulation and oversight of the industry. In Washington, FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
According to the Center for Disease Control, any of the more than 13,000 people who received this tainted steroid shot could contract meningitis. Symptoms include fever, headache, neck stiffness, sensitivity to light, weakness, numbness, pain, redness, and swelling. It is not contagious, but it can be fatal. The New England Compounding Center, which produced the drug, issued a voluntary recall over the weekend of all of its products currently in circulation. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is also requesting that all doctors and patients who bought the medication from the company keep it in a secure place and wait for instructions on how to safely dispose of it. But many consumer advocates, including Public Citizen's Michael Carome, said there should be stronger safety measures to make sure this doesn't happen in the first place.
When someone goes to see their physician with back pain and they're getting an injected medication that's supposed to be sterile, they probably reasonably expect that that drug has been reviewed and approved by the Food and Drug Administration and was made in accordance with the highest standards for making a sterile medication, and that unfortunately wasn't the case in this incident.
Carome said the FDA has almost no authority over compounding pharmacies, like the one that produced the contaminated drug. They're treated under the law like regular neighborhood pharmacies, which only mix and alter drugs for specific patients, and which are loosely regulated by the states. The compounding could be as simple as diluting a syrup or crushing a pill for a child. Some facilities still operate like that, but some, like the New England Compounding Center, have grown into massive operations that produce drugs and sell them around the country. Carome believes they should be considered manufacturers.
Drug manufacturers have to adhere to very strict standards. They have to prove that the drug is both safe and effective. And then once they have approval, they have to follow what are called good manufacturing practices, in which the FDA has oversight to make sure that the drugs are manufactured in a safe way and that they have the drug that they're supposed to have and that they don't have toxic components or bacterial or fungal contaminants. In the case of compounding pharmacies, none of those requirements apply.
The FDA also lacks the authority to order a recall of a tainted drug, but some in Congress want to change that. Connecticut Democrat Richard Blumenthal, California Democrat Henry Waxman, and Massachusetts Democrat Ed Markey are calling for hearings and an investigation on the issue. In a letter to the FDA, Markey said the compounding pharmacies, quote, fall into a regulatory black hole. He asked the agency if they have the authority they need to protect patients and consumers, or whether Congress needs to pass a new law. The International Academy of Compounding Pharmacies estimates that there are more than 7,500 U.S. pharmacies that specialize in advanced compounding, and that compounded medicines account for between 1 and 3% of all prescriptions. Carome says if the FDA does acquire authority over these operations, they should be given the full funding they need to do an effective job.
Really, we have a public health disaster given the number of people who have been infected across the country. This clearly warrants additional action and additional resources that the FDA should be directing towards this problem.
The authority question could also be resolved in the courtroom. Over the past few years, two appeals courts have ruled two different ways on the FDA's power to put limits on compounding pharmacies, and the issue could reach the Supreme Court in 2013. Alice Holstein, FSRN, Washington.
In Syria, clashes continued in cities across the country and along the border with Turkey as tensions increased in the region. Turkey said it deployed fighter jets to an airbase near the border and reported shelling from Syria. Turkey has returned fire into Syria. Speaking in Brussels today, NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen said that Turkey has a right to defend itself within international law and that NATO is prepared to act.
We have all necessary plans in place to protect and defend Turkey if necessary. We hope it won't be necessary. We hope that all parties involved will show restraint and avoid an escalation of the crisis.
Some of the most intense fighting is taking place in the northern city of Aleppo, where forces are locked in a battle for the city. For more, we're joined from Beirut, Lebanon, by Sebastian, a photojournalist who recently returned from inside Syria, where he was reporting on the situation in Aleppo. We're only using his first name for safety reasons. Welcome to FSRN.
Hi, how are you?
You were in Aleppo for 2 weeks, embedded with fighters with the Free Syrian Army. Describe your routine and your access there.
Yes, I pretty much lived with them for 2 weeks. I ate, slept, bathed, did everything pretty much they did. So I pretty much followed their daily life from morning to night.
And at one point, you witnessed how fighters were treating a captured regime fighter. We're going to play audio from that instance in a moment, but we should warn listeners, there is abuse and sounds of distress in this audio. That's audio from inside Syria, and we're speaking with photojournalist Sebastian about his time there with the Free Syrian Army. Sebastian, describe what we just listened to.
Well, I'm not going to say it was at night, but it was late afternoon, and I was at one of the front lines with a katiba of Free Syrian Army fighters. We were in the neighborhood of Salah ad-Din, which is one of the most kinetic front lines currently in Aleppo. And you can hear some gunshots as we're retreating into one of the home bases of the FSA fighters. And as I make myself inside the building, I ended up into a room, quite large room, where I found a man with both his hands and legs tied behind his back, who was being severely beaten with a hollow, I guess it was a hollow plastic tube. He was being beaten in his back and in his feet. And I asked immediately what was going on, what was happening, and one of the fighters with whom I became good friends with told me that he was a captured regime soldier, and they were simply questioning him as he had information. And in the audio, you can hear him, say, please stop, I'll kiss your feet, you know, I'll give you anything you guys want. And one of the FSA commanders, I suppose, kept asking him, give us the information, who did you talk with? So this was pretty much what happened.
And about how many people were there?
I would say that there were around 7 to 10 people all around this person.
All FSA fighters?
All of them fighters. All of them FSA fighters, yes.
Human rights activists, including researchers with Human Rights Watch, have documented abuse by both regime forces and rebel forces in a written response to a Human Rights Watch report in August that included instances of abuse by the opposition fighters. Leaders with the Military Council for the Aleppo Governorate said that it had reiterated its commitment to humanitarian law and human rights to Free Syrian Army groups, and that it was in the process of establishing special committees to review detention conditions and practices. That was in August, but from what you're describing, it appears that this treatment is still taking place.
Yes, I mean, it's obvious. You can hear it, and I've witnessed it, and it's something that has eventually... I mean, the FSA is not an organized military group. There's no organization backing it. You have to understand that these people not only are, you know, as I said before, fighting on the front line, but these people have to also, you know, cover their backs. The fighters have to find a way to, I guess, find information. And I'm not saying that torture is the right way of doing it, but I can understand how it ends up being so.
Photojournalist Sebastian spoke to us from Beirut, Lebanon, about his time with the Free Syrian Army in Aleppo. We're using only his first name for safety reasons. Sebastian, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Free Speech Radio News is a choice that matters. Respected worldwide for our coverage of social justice issues, our investigations into how government and corporate policies affect people, and our monitoring of environmental threats, struggles for equality, and much more. You choose to listen to FSRN to hear stories and voices ignored and unheard in the corporate and government press. Find out how you can help support us at our website, fsrn.org, where you can also download our newscasts, documentaries, and special reports. FSRN, a choice that matters. In Florida, voters will find 11 amendments to the state's constitution on the November ballot. One of them would overrule parts of Florida's privacy law and eliminate some rights for women. While Amendment 6 reads as a push to outlaw public funding for abortions, opponents say it has some less obvious ramifications and is another step by conservatives toward outlawing abortions in the state. FSRN's Janelle Irwin reports.
Amendment 6 has two main components. It states that public funds may not be expended for any abortion or for health benefits coverage. That includes coverage of abortion, except in cases of rape, incest, or when a woman's life is in danger. It also would reverse earlier court rulings that give women in Florida broader privacy rights than what federal laws require. That means that if Roe v. Wade is ever overturned, female Floridians would lose their extra layer of privacy protection with respect to access to abortion. It also means where abortions are concerned, medical records would no longer be protected. Supporters of the measure say that component paves the way for a law that would require parental consent for a minor to undergo an abortion procedure. Vivian Taylor, a volunteer coordinator for the reproductive rights group I Am Choice, says the measure would demonize women for their reproductive choices.
No one wants their medical records or their personal information made public information, and that's what Amendment 6 would do in essence.
Taylor and other members of the group launched a campaign to defeat the abortion amendment. The ballot initiative was introduced by Republican State Representative Dennis Baxley in 2011 and then approved for the ballot by the conservative-led legislature. Florida's constitution states that every natural person has the right to be let alone and free from governmental intrusion into the person's private life. Prior court rulings have set precedent that Florida's privacy laws are broader than the federal government's, which makes requiring a minor to obtain consent for an abortion unconstitutional. Amendment 6 would not by itself require parental consent for minors seeking abortions, but it would give lawmakers the legal foothold to introduce future parental consent legislation.
This is a step leading to future state legislation that would bring back the need for parental consent for minor women.
Jim Frankowiak is the campaign manager for the Yes on 6 campaign in favor of the amendment. He's also leading marketing efforts for another amendment on the November ballot that would allow public dollars to be spent on private religious institutions. He said Amendment 6 is necessary to ensure parents will one day have the right to weigh in on what he sees as an important, long-lasting medical decision.
You know, today kids can't get an aspirin at school, can't get a body piercing or a tattoo without parental consent, but a girl under the age of 18 can get an abortion without parental consent. That's just not right.
Reproductive rights advocates are also concerned about the most obvious language in the amendment. The ballot initiative appears to focus on banning any state funding for abortions unless it was required to save a woman's life or in the case of rape or incest. Mary Freeman, president of the Democratic Women's Club of Upper Pinellas, said Amendment 6 is redundant.
First of all, when people go in to vote, they're going to see, you know, the first line that says prohibiting, you know, the government interference with, you know, government support for abortions. Well, it's already, I mean, that's already a law. I mean, come on, you know.
Freeman is referring to the Hyde Amendment. It's a federal provision that bars public funds from being used for non-medically necessary abortions. Freeman said she thinks conservatives pushing a similar state law are only doing it because of their religious beliefs.
They shouldn't let their religious beliefs, you know, be come into a factor in what happens to other women. And I mean, they should just, you know, think about themselves and not worry about everybody else. Let everybody make their own choices.
Some Florida residents also say the law is unnecessary. Julie Rowan is a senior citizen who lives in St. Petersburg. She said she'll be voting no on the amendment when she casts her ballot.
I don't think we need to make it a part of the state constitution, and already federal law does not allow funding of abortion, and so why do we need to have it in the state constitution?
Amendment 6 is one of 11 ballot measures voters will decide on, and some residents say they still need to research the issues. George Medeiros considers himself a reproductive rights voter, but says he doesn't know if he'll vote yes or no on the amendment.
My problem, the reason I have to spend time reading all of those constitutional amendments, is that they word them in such a way to confuse me as a regular person.
Some opponents of the measure argue that this is just another on a long list of efforts to ultimately ban abortion. I Am Choice supporter Ramona Bethke said she's concerned about what could happen if the amendment passes.
This is the gateway. This issue is the gateway. If this passes, it's going to open the door so wide, we're probably never going to be able to close it again.
Reproductive rights activists are also concerned that the amendment could wipe out organizations like Planned Parenthood because the women's health centers receive public funding. That group performs abortions, but they also offer low-cost preventative care services like mammograms and annual gynecological screenings. Planned Parenthood is running their own anti-Amendment 6 campaign called No on 6. Janelle Irwin, FSRN, Tampa.
Following Israel's military offensive into Gaza in 2009, known as Operation Cast Lead, the families of hundreds of Palestinians killed in the assault began a long legal process seeking recognition and compensation. Recently, two Israeli court decisions offered mixed results. In the case of one family who lost 22 members, the court said that the deaths were unintended results of the mistakes of war and that Israel is not responsible. But another Israeli court approved a settlement that compensates a different Gaza family for two members killed during a humanitarian break in the fighting. FSRN's Rami Almagari has more.
3 years after the Israeli war, the Shurab family from Khan Yunis won a lawsuit against the Israeli army. The family lost two of its members, 28-year-old Kassab and 18-year-old Abbas, after Israeli army forces shot them dead during a midday ceasefire in January 2009. At the Shurab family house, mother Om Kassab still grieves. While she refuses to talk about the killing of her sons, her daughter Adila Shurab explains that Israel's financial compensation of $100,000 doesn't relieve the family's agony. Adila Shurab is the sister of Kassab and Abbas.
This sum of money is very little compared to the suffering that we have endured. Most likely, we will not use this money. We will possibly donate it to others who suffer one way or another. My sister will get married in 2 weeks. We cannot imagine her wedding without her brothers who are now dead. We are imagining how they would react to the wedding if they were living. We continue to remember them on every occasion as if they were living.
The Gaza-based Palestinian Center for Human Rights helped the family file the lawsuit. The group says this is the second case in the last 2 years of what they call compromise, not compensation. Mohammed Al-Alami is a lawyer with the center. He says that Israel does not admit any legal or criminal responsibility for civilian victims in Gaza.
1 week ago, we received a confirmation from the Israeli military prosecution that they agreed to a compromise. Such a compromise was reached with no legal or criminal responsibility on the part of Israel. Israeli jurisdiction ensures a cover for Israeli army actions in the region. In August 2012, for instance, an Israeli court sentenced the officer who killed an elderly woman and her daughter to a 45-day imprisonment.
The woman and her daughter belonged to the Hajjaj family in eastern Gaza City. The two were killed during the caste-led war, and their family was the first to get financial compensation. Since the war in Gaza, the Palestinian Center for Human Rights has filed at least 100 lawsuits against the Israeli army. The cases involve more than 600 victims of the war, including 320 who were killed and 300 who were wounded. They have also filed suits regarding the destruction of 6 civilian buildings, including the Palestinian Red Crescent Society. Yet, so far, courts haven't agreed to hear the cases. Mohammed Adaya is a 32-year-old father of 5 children. He lost 22 members of his family, including his children, wife, parents, 2 sisters, and 2 brothers, nieces and nephews, when an Israeli warplane bombed the 2-story family house in southern Gaza on January 6, 2009. At the time, Adaya's wife was pregnant.
Israel has a history of exempting itself from responsibility. It is not a matter of Hamas, and if President Mahmoud Abbas was in charge here, Israel would hold Abbas responsible. All that I demand is that the Israeli government should bring to justice those who committed such a crime, in which an 8-month-old fetus was killed. I only pray to God that justice prevails.
Israel's 23-day war on Gaza that ended in January 2009 was the largest Israeli attack on the coastal territory, indicates. Israel alleged the war was needed to stop homemade rocket fire from the Hamas-ruled Gaza into nearby Israeli areas. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights has documented 1,500 Palestinians killed from the war, half of them civilian men, women, and children. Another 6,000 people were injured. It also completely destroyed 3,500 homes across the territory. According to Beit Salem, Palestinians killed 9 Israelis, including 3 civilians and 6 military personnel. Another 4 Israeli soldiers were killed by friendly fire. Rami Almighari, Afasaran, Gaza.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Nell Abram and Catherine Cobb. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.